Welcome to Rolling Start. I'm Justin Onukasi, and I am your host for this fascinating series. I speak to business leaders from all walks of life who tell us about their professional and personal journeys so far, including some of the barriers they've had to get through in order to get there. In this episode, I speak to Anna Davis, Director of Proposition at St. James's Place Wealth Management. Mother, investment leader, a true innovator in the investments and savings industry. She will tell us how she dealt with bullying in her earlier life to become the successful businesswoman she is today. Anna, it's been a while. It's great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us on Rolling Start.
Wow, that was like quite an introduction, Justin. Thank you very much.
I suppose our formative years kind of make us who we are. And you grew up in Southampton, I think, was it? Towards the south of the country. Can you tell us a bit about your childhood, family life?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I was born and brought up in Southampton. And I'd say I'd had quite a sort of traditional kind of upbringing, really. My parents met when they were quite young, and they've been married and still are married and together. And there was three of us, and I was the eldest of three daughters. And there's only a year's difference between myself and my sister Susan, and probably about 5.5 years difference between myself and Sarah. And it was quite interesting, really, in terms of those kind of younger years, in terms of how it shapes you and what you kind of learn at such an early stage. And with Susan kind of only being a year's difference, she was actually quite poorly as a child, so she had really severe eczema and asthma, and as a consequence of that, it meant that my mum used to have to spend a lot of time going in and out of hospital with Susan, and my dad was kind of the main earner and the sort of breadwinner at that point. And but it meant that in kind of free time, my dad sort of took up the reins, and I spent a lot of time with my dad. And in many ways, that kind of shaped me, because it made me fiercely independent. And he's kind of very much he was a Taurus, actually, so an earth sign, and I'm a Capricorn. I think there's kind of that ingrained kind of thing about just get on with it and pick yourself up and kind of move on. So I think I've got that fierce independence, really, from my dad. And then, but on the kind of maybe sort of feels like negative, but it isn't really kind of one of the learns from that, I guess, is that as a consequence of my sister not being kind of very, very well, it meant that actually from an early stage, I never really learned how to put myself first. And it was always about putting other people towards myself. And I think that actually had quite a bearing in terms of what that meant for me in later life. I think that kind of there were certain life events that kind of happened that I think that made me feel that I wasn't necessarily good enough. And also, by putting others towards yourself, it meant that I never really learned what it was that I wanted or how to make myself a priority on certain occasions. So, you know, one example was a big life event that I was married and went for a divorce. And when I look at kind of the things that happened during that period of time, you know, when I first met that person, he was 7 years older than me. So it's probably quite attractive or exciting, because maybe I had kind of quite a lot more to learn from him, and the age gap didn't feel so significant. But as I kind of grew as a person and had more sort of life experiences, and especially as I developed through my career, the sort of tension started to kind of appear. And I would say that when I reflect back at that kind of that marriage, that a lot of that had to do with that, you know, that traditional upbringing of always looking for solutions and working at a marriage. And the thing I hadn't recognized at the time is that that's fantastic and that's a great thing about marriage, but there was equality in my parents' marriage, but there wasn't equality in the marriage that I had. And so as a consequence of that, and that kind of, if you like, learned behavior about not knowing how to put myself first and putting other people before me, he took advantage of that, basically. And so, kind of long story short, we got divorced, but it did take me, I was married for 10 years before that kind of realization happened. And again, I look back at it and think, what I don't almost recognize myself at times in that. But by the same token, I guess I don't ever hold any kind of regrets about it either, because as consequences of things not being happy or working in my home life, then it shaped me in my career and my professional life by throwing myself into something and kind of becoming successful as a consequence.
And you met very early, didn't you? I mean, you said you were 7 years older, but you met when?
Yeah, I mean, I was only 16 at the time. I remember my parents being like horrified by, you know, basically this is a man, and they kind of saw me as a child, but it didn't kind of feel like that. The sort of, maybe when I look back, the maturity level was the same age. So I just think that there are elements of that that I think you kind of think you're, even at 16, I think I probably thought that I was kind of an adult, was quite mature, but it isn't until later on. And you know what it's like when your parents and your grandparents kind of say that it's about experience and wisdom, and you just think, oh, shut up, I know what I'm doing. And that's probably kind of what I was like at the time, being that kind of fiercely independent kind of person. And I wouldn't say I was a know-it-all, but I certainly at that point probably had a lot of clarity of thought in my own mind.
So talk a little about school and education in Southampton and where you grew up.
Yeah, so I was born and brought up on a kind of council estate actually in Southampton, and probably one of the worst council estates actually in terms of kind of its reputation. But living on the estate, I never saw the bad stuff. And again, I think that's because my parents had really strong family values, and again, very kind of traditional in terms of, I had friends that were allowed to play out the front outside, but we were always had to play in the garden. And if they wanted to come around to play, they had to come and play in the garden. And I remember thinking, oh my God, my parents are so old fashioned. And I look at that now and I think it wasn't such a bad thing in terms of making sure that we sort of stayed on the right path, if you like, by kind of having maybe some of those rules in place. And we went to a local first and middle school, and also I went to an all-girls secondary school. And I remember school was quite a challenge for me, because I went to a different, in those days it was a playgroup as opposed to a kind of a nursery, and everybody else went to a different one. So when I went to school, I didn't know anybody and I didn't have any friends. And I remember kind of going around the class saying, will you be my friend? And people saying to me, no, don't want to be your friend. Children can be quite cruel, can't they? And I remember being ever so upset. And I went home that kind of day and said to my mom, I don't want to go back to school. But naturally, of course, you have to go back to school. And I went around with the same question. And then there was one girl called Lindsay, actually, who said, no, I'll be your friend. And I look back now and it's probably like the best thing that happened, because she was a very sort of studious type person too. So it meant that I was kind of, again, stayed on that straight and narrow from a schooling perspective. I think the other things that kind of shaped me in that way was that my, as a consequence of my sister not being well, I think that you can kind of go one or two paths. You can kind of be rebellious or you can be a good girl. And for me, I just really wanted to be a good girl and not cause my parents any problems. And again, as a consequence of that, it meant that I think that was a reason why I really concentrated on wanting to be the best and be the best that I could be at school. And and so I kind of threw myself into study and wanting to kind of, yeah, do really well. And I really enjoyed school as a consequence of that.
Yeah. And what about, you mentioned Lindsay, but what about other friendships in school? I mean, do you create a lot of bonds in school, or do you enjoy it as you got older?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of early years were a bit tougher. And again, kind of, I remember some other experiences where I didn't really always feel that I would fit in because I had red hair. And as a consequence of having red hair and freckles at the time, you were called ginger nut. And I remember this one particular boy who was in the year above, and every day I used to walk to school and he used to be in front and he used to call me ginger nut. And it took about 6 months until I told my mum that, you know, Nathan's calling me a ginger nut. And she said, oh, well, you tell him, you haven't got ginger hair, you've got auburn hair. So then I remember the next day saying to him, my mum said, I haven't got ginger hair, I've got auburn hair. And he said to me, oh, okay, so you're not a ginger nut, you're an auburn bourbon. So I went from one bloody biscuit in the biscuit tin to another. But as a child, that was quite demoralizing, and kind of I had this stigma basically about being a ginger, and that was quite hard because it made me feel different. And as a child, you just want to fit in. You just want to be the same as everybody else. And I felt like I stuck out because I was a redhead with freckles.
Do you think, you know, I went to a comprehensive school and it wasn't very ethnically diverse, right? So it was majority white school. And I got called all names under the sun. And, you know, clearly racism is taken, you know, dealt with quite harshly and seen as quite rightly as, you know, unacceptable. But do you think that, and then things like, you know, having ginger hair and people name calling for ginger hair is kind of like swept under the carpet a little bit. Do you think that we should pay more attention to just bullying and name calling just in general, and not have these extremes, which means that, you know, things like this would just get swept under the carpet, imagine, by the teachers?
Do you know what, Justin? It's a really great question, because my gut feel is, well, I want to say yeah, because of the way that it made me feel. But then I look at it on balance and I think, but it also had a lot of the way that it shaped me in terms of that kind of building resilience and bouncing back and being driven. And almost I kind of wanted to sort of prove that actually I was okay. And whilst I may have gone through some tough times to get there, maybe if that hadn't happened, I don't know if I would be where I am today. But on balance, I think that kind of you should always say yes, they should address those things at school, and kind of bullying is just unacceptable. And there are all different kind of phases of, you know, all different types of bullying.
You're obviously getting a lot of this stick from other children. How did you cope with that? Did you have a coping mechanism?
I did actually, but I think it wasn't kind of until I got to secondary school. So through that kind of sort of primary, sort of, you know, middle, that time, I think that I was quite shy and just wanted to be good, so I didn't want to create any issues. And if I'm honest, I wouldn't have brought it to the teacher's attention for them to deal with anyway, because I just didn't want any fuss, and I didn't want the light to be shining on me any more than it already was as being a ginger nut. Yeah. But when I went to secondary school, actually things started to change a bit, and I think probably because there are more opportunities in terms of kind of the lessons that you can have. And again, when I went to secondary school, I kind of quickly realized that actually if you were good at sport, you didn't get bullied. And so I remember like this whole driver for me to be the best, and I remember starting secondary school and I was put in the second set instead of the top set, so I worked really, really hard to get into this top set, and it didn't take me too long because I was quite tenacious about kind of wanting to be there. So maybe it was like 6 months or so, and I got into the top set. But then as a consequence of that, you get called the boffin and all the other kind of brilliant and kind of, you know, things that happened. But then I kind of threw myself into sport, and I was pretty good at it, which was kind of that was actually for me kind of my saving grace, if you like, that I was good at sport, so actually the bullies didn't kind of pick on me so much.
So you left school.
Yeah.
And you went looking for a job. You didn't go to university.
Yeah, so I left school. I did go to college and did my A levels. But again, I kind of, you know, having been born and brought up on a kind of a council estate, my mum and dad didn't have loads of money, but I always feel like we did get lots of love and attention. But I kind of felt that, and again, the traditional values actually was that my mum and dad were like, you know, you have to really save hard. If you want something, you have to save for it, and then you can kind of, you know, buy it. So I kind of had that kind of savings kind of culture and live within your means. So the thought of going to university and knowing that it would put my parents under quite a lot of pressure to pay for it, even though I knew that they would find it. If, you know, that's because that's absolutely what they wanted for me. And I remember them being really bitterly kind of disappointed because they felt that I was bright enough to go to university, and I wanted to be an urban planner. So maybe I could be kind of working for a sort of a supermarket now, deciding where their next plot's going to be. But obviously, life took a different course and I ended up in financial services. But what happened was that in the end, they agreed I could, you know, go for work, go and get a job, earn some money for a year. But after a year, you've definitely got to go to university. Okay, I'll do that. So I started at Scandia, which is obviously now Old Mutual, but they had a big presence in Southampton. And I started as a office junior. I remember kind of listening to the guys that were on the phone. It was called a broker line, thinking, oh, wow, they really know what they're talking about. And I really want to know what I'm talking about. And I remember going to the managers just saying, well, could I like have a job on the phones? And they sort of politely sort of said, you know, well, that's really fantastic, but you're enthusiastic, but you kind of need to be here a bit longer than 6 months before you can do that job. But I guess luck kind of came into it, and maybe lucky for me, but maybe not lucky for other people, because it was kind of one of the first sort of my experiences of a stock market downturn, and they did a recruitment freeze and somebody left the broker line desk and they were under-resourced, and so they turned to me and said, so do you still want to give it a crack? And I was like, definitely. And that was my crash course in investments, speaking to financial advisors about life and pension funds, which was fantastic, because before that I was manually putting in asset allocations to do manual fact sheets on MicroPal and kind of Hindsight and through sort of a Quasar system. So anybody that's kind of been in the industry long enough to remember some of those systems, that was kind of my first job.
And just thinking about how you got into finance, was it just that you wanted to find any job, or was it that you particularly thought, actually, this is a good business, I want to go and work for them, or I want to go and work in finance for the year?
I never chose financial services, but I did choose the big massive building in Southampton that looked great with these like blue windows, and that was in the centre of town. And I just thought, wow, that's like an amazing building, I want to work there. Probably looks quite old and dated now, but yeah, a bit shallow, Justin, but that was probably what it was. But actually, I look back at that and think, do you know what? There's probably not too much wrong with making that as a decision, because it was a great company, a great sort of corporate environment. The types of benefits that you get from working in financial services, like pensions. And as I say, my parents were already kind of a savings kind of culture, but it introduced me into kind of investment and that type of thing. So I think it's stood me in good stead. And as a consequence, really, of being there, I remember after the first year, I was supposed to go back, you know, go to university. And I know this sounds quite crude, but I actually started to enjoy earning money. And so I was 19 and I saw this kind of house, and it was an ex-council authority house. It was three bedrooms. It had no hot running water or anything. And the house had like metal framed windows, and just to kind of paint a picture, it was 60 grand. And it was kind of in the days of kind of when you could get 100% mortgage. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So I got my first house when I was 19.
Of course, you're in a relationship then, right?
Yeah. So in that point, I wasn't married, but I was in a relationship. And again, if I reflect back, that probably did have some standing on why I didn't go to university too, because I guess I felt that I thought I was lucky that somebody had paid some interest into me, and then secondly, kind of, if I went to university, was I going to lose this person? And at the time, it's probably taken me a few years actually to really admit that probably was quite a significant factor in being held back, or kind of anchored in a place that maybe if I'd made some different choices, I could have moved on more. But again, I just think you choose a path, and I've had some challenges and some not very nice things happen to me, but by the same token, I think I wouldn't have found happiness with like my husband that I've got now and a beautiful daughter if I hadn't, because I've learned some hard lessons about what I don't want more than what I do want.
On the self-esteem, just coming back to that. Now, I've always known you as, at least externally, being very confident, actually exuding confidence in a way. And I've always seen you as a leader. I just wonder, you know, when you started off at Scandia, did that self-esteem ever affect you in any way at all, do you think?
Yeah, it's like, it's really weird because I am confident, but I did lack a lot of self-esteem in terms of that whole thing in the back of my mind that was I was never good enough. And and I think that I remember thinking I'm never ever going to become a manager because I don't have a degree. And that probably did hold me back a bit in terms of that whilst I kind of did progress kind of well throughout kind of my time, I was always somebody that looked for solutions and gaps to kind of go and do those types of, you know, roles. But I do remember the day that I made manager, and again, it was in times when you got a car parking space in the office, and I honestly just said I thought I'd made it because I got a car parking space, but I still got the bus into work. So, yeah, I think there's loads of things on that, because I could probably give loads of examples. And even now, I think now I've got to a point in my life, and we were joking before we jumped on actually that kind of I said that I hit 40 in December, but it has taken me these 40 years to be able to say that actually that has been one of my issues, and I can recognize it now, even probably accept it to some degree, but it's still there. It's absolutely still there. And so there are times when it still kind of creeps in, or have that sort of slight fear of, God, am I going to be able to do this? And am I good enough? And I remember feeling like that actually when I went through the sort of interview process for the role that I've got now. But I just kind of try to find ways to manage it and tell myself not to be so silly.
Let's come on to that a bit later, because I'm curious about your tenure at Scandia, because it came to an end, and it was around about, was it the dot-com crisis?
Yeah, it was. And but it wasn't really as a consequence of markets that it came to an end. It was more Old Mutual took over the Scandia group, but I think by the time I left, they were probably had taken over for about maybe three years or so, but there was quite a lot of transition and a lot of change. And I think that I'd been there for 12 years in the end, and it's quite a long time. But again, this putting it pretty crudely, that I wasn't going to be the one that chooses to leave, because I'd got to a place where, you know, I had things like for share save and that type of stuff. So I felt pretty invested. So I wanted to check before I went. So I just kind of knew that if I just waited, and that the time would come. And I'd made it clear that, you know, I was quite comfortable that if I was somebody that needed to be made redundant, that was okay. And that time eventually did come. When I look back, I think at the time I thought it was maybe because I wasn't quite good enough. But now I realise it was just a consequence of where the industry was at the time. And I really wanted to get into distribution. And I felt that I had been a client and having worked at Scandia, and at the time it was like the, you know, it was the pinnacle. It was like the biggest kind of, you know, platform and life and pension provider, and the relationships that they had with sort of, you know, different distribution channels was immense. And I'd have 12 years of experience of kind of really understanding how that all worked. I felt that I had something to give on the other side of the fence. And I remember kind of applying for kind of sales roles, and some of the other kind of asset management companies talking to me about it. But basically it came down to, because I didn't have a black book of contacts of financial advisors, they just wouldn't give me an opportunity. So again, it was kind of very much around who you knew as opposed to what your transferable skills were, until actually I came across, I met, somebody introduced me to Simon Ellis, and he did see the value in having somebody like that that could support with looking at that distribution strategy. And that's when I joined Algium as a business strategy manager.
And do you think the, not just our industry, but do you think the corporate sphere has changed? Do you think it's changed enough, or do you think there's still a long ways to go?
Well, I think that there's pockets of places which are kind of ahead, and there's other places which I think have stood still, and as a consequence of that have kind of gone backwards. I think it's all about kind of the sort of culture and the leadership at the helm. I remember after leaving Elgium actually and wanting to look for, after I'd had my daughter and coming back into the industry, I'd kind of read all of this stuff about sort of, you know, diversity and inclusion and that the industry had kind of set up kind of, you know, more of a sort of project to do that. And they really wanted to support people that had been in the industry getting back into work. But I think that the media story was probably more colourful than the actual experience, because that's not how I felt when I tried to get back into the industry. And whilst people kind of approached me, I was really looking for something around flexible kind of working. And I was really upfront and honest about, you know, with people in terms of what it was that I was looking for, because I'd moved to a different part of the country and commuting to London really wasn't going to be sort of tenable. I was upfront and honest about flexibility and kind of what it was that I was looking for, you know, predominantly having a more sort of home-based working environment. And I'd get quite right to the end of the interview, even to the point that it was kind of they were offering, but they were offering on the basis that I could have flexible working. You know, they said they hadn't changed their mind, but actually flexible working meant that I could work from home on a Friday. And that just was not going to work.
It is really strange, isn't it, that and I think the pandemic in some ways have forced the industry into a more flexible working environment, because I don't think we're going back to being in the office 5 days a week. I just can't see that happening, given the technology now is all there and set up and established.
And I think that's like been a fantastic and wonderful outcome of COVID, because I think that it will give kind of financial services a much bigger kind of span and breadth of talented people that can be happy in their home lives and feel kind of anchored and balanced, but also be able to fulfill a successful career. So I just think there's something good to have come out of this, then that has to be it.
So eventually you got back in though. You got back in, yeah. You found somewhere which was willing to offer you something that was quite flexible. So can you go into some detail about that?
Yeah, so then I was, you know, this was another kind of sort of really where some of the sort of self-doubt came back in terms of that kind of self-esteem. And I took 18 months out of the industry. And again, you kind of sort of talk yourself into the industry must have really moved on and my knowledge is going to be really kind of outdated. And I guess I was kind of thinking that, oh, I don't really want to go back into a senior role because I've never been a mother before. And I moved to an area which, you know, I've got no friends and family on the doorstep. So I'm 2.5 hours really away from that. So I now live in Worcestershire. But I think this was another thing about having like good network and a good reputation, because I worked with a guy called Steve Jones in Elgium and on a project there. And he was working for a discretionary fund manager. And he said to me, Anna, we've got loads of stuff you could come and do for us. You know, we're that kind of just being bought by or a couple of years by SJP, and there's no end of kind of work that you'd be really helpful with. And he was like, yeah, completely open-minded about flexibility. I think that's because I had a bit of form that Steve kind of knew what he was getting by kind of working with me and through reputation. And for me, it was like a great opportunity, because I think it doesn't matter what you think about certain kind of companies, that SJP is still a fantastic like company to kind of have on your CV, again, to put it kind of quite crudely, and to work for a discretionary. I thought, well, that's a bit different, because I've always worked retail and sort of, you know, platforms, life and pension. I've worked in asset management. Now actually it gives me another string to my bow, because I'm going to learn about wealth management. I was like, that's really fantastic to have a really well-rounded distribution career. That's what I did.
Yeah, I suppose kind of just looking back over your career, successful career, I clearly do a lot of work on diversity and inclusion. And I've heard some horror stories actually from, you know, women particularly when they start off at, you know, early ages. And you've spoken a little bit about, you know, things like banter, flexible work, and these inflexible structural issues that we know exist in not just our industry, you know, across the corporate sphere. But I just wonder whether, you know, as a woman, you've felt that you belong in the industry that's dominated by men.
Yeah, it's really weird, I think, because in some ways, I think that there were certain things that happened, like I said, about kind of the banter, and actually that's probably, some of it was a bit borderline bullying, really. And but on the other hand, I actually found it easier to get on with male colleagues than female colleagues, not because I didn't get on with female colleagues, but I think it was just because I'd spent so much time with my dad. And so it was kind of quite comfortable to sort of be in that sort of male company, because I found that they were less judgmental. And so I could just kind of do, they just kind of looked at what I did as a job, and I was kind of, it was like merit for that, really. So in some ways I feel that I had a good experience actually kind of working in a male dominated industry. And I also think that being female, I used it to my advantage, as in it made me different, especially when I was kind of negotiating. I think that people, I think that, you know, if I recognized that they did have unconscious bias about me being a female and I was kind of leading negotiations, I think that put me in a position of strength. Like you, I've heard some real horror stories, some things that are totally unacceptable. But I feel that I've always worked in areas that have actually been much more forward thinking and maybe more liberal in terms of the way that they thought. And so in many ways, I've been very lucky and very fortunate not to have had those experiences.
Yeah. And so just coming back to the self-esteem, and you mentioned, you know, right at the beginning of the talk that you realized that this was a challenge for you early on, and now you seem to, you realize that, you know, you do have to think more about yourself and you know, stop putting people in front of you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to understand what you've done to change this.
Yeah, I've done some quite weird and wacky stuff actually to kind of go through that. I know it's a bit of a cliche word to say go through that journey, but I think hard times, if you have got a loving family, work through it. I've always been somebody that said don't live in the past, just learn from the history and move on. And kind of, again, that sort of fierce independence that I kind of learned from my dad, I'd say that kind of really has been something that's been a foundation for me to sort of drive forwards. But, you know, I remember after I got divorced, I thought, what's wrong with me? How could I let somebody treat me like that? I must be, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. And I knew that I was a relationships person, and I wanted to, you know, be in a marriage and all of those things. And so I went for counselling. And that was kind of my first part, actually, where it made me recognise that actually it wasn't there was nothing wrong with me. In fact, I was a nice person, but being nice doesn't mean to say that everybody treats you with respect or with equality. But there was equality, but I didn't learn about equality really until I realized that I didn't have it. And then I said about weird and wacky stuff, that I did some kind of like spiritual healing, and I still don't know if I believe in spirits and that type of thing, but I do believe that mind is really powerful. And I think that kind of getting your brain in the gym is the same as getting your body in the gym. And so I kind of felt that I needed to sort of rewire my brain, if you like, to kind of not continue with the same patterns. And so I learned how to read the tarot, but don't ask me to do it because I'd be really rubbish, but it was because I was too much in my head about what I was thinking about things, as opposed to following my intuition. So I felt like I needed to do something quite different. And really the tarot is about being intuitive and like believing in your gut feel. But I do think mind over matter is really quite powerful.
So for people who are junior in the industry, actually may not be actually junior, but just people that are struggling with self-esteem, what's the advice that you would give them if they're stuck in a rut and they can't get out of it?
I think the first thing that, for me, the first thing that I needed to do was to acknowledge it and to understand what it was, what were the triggers that were giving me that kind of self-esteem. And that's a bit of soul searching, actually, and it's a bit of admitting, if you like, to kind of things that have maybe happened in your past, and sometimes mapping that kind of, you know, from childhood, the, your most happiest occasions and your sad occasions actually is quite a simple but good exercise to be able to then recognize where's that almost, I don't know, this is an industry term, volatility in your kind of in your life cycle. But it's a really good way of understanding kind of those moments of, yeah, real happiness and kind of sad kind of events, and being able to acknowledge, well, what were the consequences and what did that do for me? So I think that you have to face into it, and you have to kind of look at it in the mirror, and it's the only way to deal with it.
Last question from me. What does the future have in store for you, Anna?
All seriousness, I feel that after kind of the things that I've done and tried and tested, what I've learned about myself is that I want to be part of building the future. I need something which helps with my intellectual kind of curiosity. And I want something where I can kind of build and shape and be a kind of a change agent. And I feel that I'm in, like, I've got the best opportunity ever in the new role that I've got. And again, I have to just manage my demons to kind of like that, you know, I am good enough to, absolutely good enough to do this job. But my learn for me next is I need to learn how to enjoy it now and enjoy the experience that I've got. And I can't tell you how excited I am in this new role, because again, it's kind of like the dream job, really, that it's got all of those things that really drive and energize me, and things I've still got to kind of learn some new stuff with. And I've got a really super talented team, so perhaps I'll get found out in this job. But yeah, I just I think that for me it's kind of really making a difference in terms of the role that I've got now at SJP. And after that, I actually don't know, Justin.
Yeah.
I've only just started this role, so if they keep me, I've got some I've got a few years ahead yet.
Anna, absolutely fantastic, inspiring story. Thank you for joining us today. I hope you all enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If you've been inspired by Anna's story, please go to rollingstart.org.uk for more information. On the next episode, we'll be speaking to Ryan Pereira, Global Director, Gas and LNG at Gaffney Klein. He will tell us how bereavement and childbirth complications have impacted his life and the importance of faith, family, and deep lasting friendships. Until then, see you soon.